Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
You're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and a member of the Christians for Liberty Network. Patrick Carroll is our guest. He's a libertarian opinion journalist based near Toronto, Canada. His work has been featured by numerous organizations, including the Mises Institute, Libertarian Institute, the American Institute for Economic Research, all the institutes, all the good institutes, and the Foundation for Economic Education, where he formerly served as managing editor. His work has received hundreds of thousands of views and has been shared by influential figures, including Jordan Peterson, Senator Rand Paul, and Argentine President Javier Milei. In October 2025, he launched his Substack, Against the Left, where he responds to left-wing articles and videos from a free market perspective. Patrick, how you doing today, pal?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah. Please do. I'm trying to get you on for a little bit, so I'm happy that you're here. So the primary thing I think we're going to be talking about is an article on your Substack, Against the Left, that was called Why SNAP Spending Should Be Cut Even If Charity Doesn't Replace It. And it recounts last year's lengthy government shutdown under which SNAP, or often referred to as food stamps, ran out, the benefits for it. And so you also interact with a piece by Carl Bayer for Jacobin, where he argues that this experiment essentially proved that we do, in fact, need state welfare programs because private charity can't possibly pick up all the slack, right? And so what were the data points that Bayer, to start with, was seizing upon to make his case? What was Bayer's case?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, we had the really long government shutdown last year. It was actually a record-breaking length. And one of the things that happened is that, especially around the beginning of November, as the shutdown was getting into its second month, the pressure started heating up. And more things that maybe had a buffer in the initial weeks, that buffer started to run out. And so one of those things was food stamps, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, as it's commonly known. This is a really large welfare program run by the Department of Agriculture. And currently it's sitting at about $100 billion a year. And it goes to about 40 million Americans, so about 1 in 8 Americans. And so this is a really big deal. There are many Americans who rely on this program for their basic weekly groceries. And so it was a very big deal when, at the end of October, the Department of Agriculture announced on their website, sorry, the well has run dry. We are going to be shutting off funding for food stamps because of the government shutdown starting in November. And so that immediately caused a lot of chaos. There was a lot of legal chaos. There was a lot of chaos in, obviously, the charitable sector. And a lot of people just who are very dependent on this program, who were suddenly faced with the question of, am I going to be able to afford my groceries next week? And so the story that ensued over the next 2 weeks, so about the first 2 weeks of November, became rather complicated. There were a whole bunch of legal challenges and, basically a bunch of mounting pressure that fortunately kind of subsided once the government shutdown was resolved. Everything kind of went back to normal. But in that week or two period, in the beginning of November, there was a really interesting thing that happened, which basically never happens, which is that food stamps were actually kind of cut off, at least for a few days. And so specifically November 1st, 2nd, 3rd, people were scrambling. And what ended up happening was that SNAP funding did get at least delayed for a number of people. And that immediately put a huge strain on food banks. As you can imagine, when millions of people are relying on food stamps and suddenly those aren't available even for 2 or 3 days, suddenly your food banks are going to start getting overwhelmed. And sure enough, that's what happened. And so this leftist commentator, Carl Bayer, who wrote this piece for his Substack, which then got picked up by Jacobin the next day, he was saying, he was pointing to overwhelmed food banks in a lot of different parts of the country, and noting how, like, this is directly caused, and no one denies this was directly caused by the fact that SNAP funding had lapsed. And so he was basically making the point that, like, hey, these free market commentators are always assuring us that private charity can step in to fill the gap if the public welfare, if government welfare were ever to go away. And yet, here we have a clear example, he says, of government welfare suddenly drying up and private charity isn't coming in to fill the gap. Instead, we just have overwhelmed food banks, which is exactly what the leftists say they have always predicted. And so these were some of the data points. And he showcases a few particular instances where, you know, reporters are talking to people in the food bank lines and they're saying, oh, you know, I have to rely on food stamps and I don't normally have to come to the food bank, but today I have to be here because the food stamp funding has lapsed. And so no one denies there was absolutely a crisis that was created, specifically where food banks started receiving a lot more pressure than normal. And I think the question that Bayer picks up and that I pick up is, okay, what should we take away from this? No one disputes that these data points exist and that they're alarming, but how should this impact, or should this impact at all, our thinking about public policy when it comes to welfare policy and specifically food stamps?
Well, and you know, one thing that occurs to me as you recount on that story is you're talking about a pretty short period, just a few days, mm-hmm. and you have, it's, you know, I was in Europe recently, and I understand that, you know, they tend to shop daily oftentimes for meals. But in America, we kind of do like a weekly shop, right? And so it's interesting that they were overwhelmed in such a short period of time, which does sort of suggest to me that it's kind of like the phenomenon that we have in the States, and I'm sure in Canada too, where there's a winter storm that's declared and everybody rushes and buys like, you know, 10 gallons of milk. And, you know, I wonder if that's part of it. You know, that there's this kind of sudden thing, but you also, you suggest that, you know, one flaw in Bayer's argument, and you point out others, but this is just kind of a smaller one to start with, could be more on the scale of time than money, that it is possible that the market could fill in that gap, but that a significant amount of organizational buildup would maybe need to take place. This was kind of, I mean, there were some concerns that it could be coming, but it wasn't totally clear that was going to happen. You know, just speaking anecdotally, I personally saw my community rallying to help my neighbors during that time period, you know, businesses, churches, different organizations. Do you think with more notice, if it's kind of known that this is happening, that there's a buildup over, you know, and over the next year, we're going to be, you know, cutting out these funds, significantly more could be done? Because I mean, when I think about our kind of pre, you know, Rooseveltian pre-welfare kind of, you know, society that we had, you had all of these voluntary associations and things, and all those sort of dried up over time as government replaced them. But, you know, there's certainly, you know, presumably that stuff can be built, but it maybe doesn't happen in a couple of days. So do you think that that's at least possible, that with time, all those deficits could be met?
Yeah. So I don't think that, given enough time, the free market charitable networks would completely replace the $100 billion. If we just said that we were going to get rid of the $100 billion SNAP program, I don't think that private charity would then step in to the tune of $100 billion. However, I do think it would certainly step in to a considerable degree. And as you said, we already saw that in the few days in the beginning of November. So Bayer raises this point himself. He kind of acknowledges that this is a weakness in his argument. And he says, well, some people will surely comment that private charity just didn't have enough time. It didn't have enough notice to ramp up alternatives. And he kind of dismisses this argument. And he says, oh, well, you know, those free marketers keep telling us that the market is so efficient. So, you know, if it's so efficient, well, why can't it ramp up private charity in 2 or 3 days? It's like, well, we're not utopians. Just because the market is more efficient than the government doesn't mean that you can suddenly have large-scale institutions and infrastructure in a matter of days. Like, come on, be realistic. And so I think his dismissiveness toward that argument is unwarranted. I do think that part of the reason why we didn't see more of a response from private charity is because there was very little warning and so much uncertainty. And Bayer says, oh, well, they knew the government was shut down since October 1st. Yeah, first of all, that's still only a month. That's not a lot of time to scale up large enterprises. Second of all, there was no guarantee that SNAP funding was going to be cut off. Nobody knew, right? We all lived through this. It was a day by day, like, oh, is it going to be shut down tomorrow? We don't really know. There's tremendous uncertainty. And so the idea that the private charitable sector ought to have been planning from October 1st for a 3-day window in November where it was going to have to step up and completely replace Snap. Like, this is just starting to lay expectations on private charity that I think are completely unreasonable. And so in my article that I wrote responding to Bayer's piece for my Substack Against the Left, I talk about, okay, let's imagine that there was complete certainty that Snap was going to be cut off and there was like 6 months of notice. Do you think the private charitable response, the up step in private charity would have been more pronounced than it was in November? Obviously, yes. It was actually quite laudable the degree to which private charitable institutions pivoted on a dime and did step up in early November. And Bayer kind of suggests that, well, it was a very lackluster response. I think it was actually a very impressive response. And I point to some of the data points in the article where, these big institutions really rallied and really stepped up probably a lot more than many people expected. I think DoorDash was giving out free meals. There was just a lot of charitable efforts to help people weather this storm. But I think that, if there was 6 months notice and complete certainty, Bayer would still have a point that the charity that was forthcoming wouldn't completely replace food stamps. But I don't think it would nearly have been the gap that we actually saw because of all of the uncertainty around the government shutdown.
Sorry, I couldn't remember if I was muted or not. So, and you brought up an interesting point there. There's I think Bayer's argument is that if this is how much we're spending on food stamp, SNAP benefits, various welfare programs, then that's how much we should be spending. That it's almost like that need is kind of a static need, right? And you're essentially arguing that that's not necessarily the case. One, I guess, more positive argument that could be developed is if we had a freer market, then some of the things that keep people in poverty now would be removed, that there would be more opportunities to work and build businesses and be able to afford homes, afford health insurance, different things like that, afford food. So I think that's part of it. But the other argument you make, and this is where I think you might sound a little bit Scroogey, is you point out that 1/8 of Americans are on SNAP benefits, and that 39% of those people who are on SNAP benefits are in fact obese, which in fairness to them may say more about the foods that SNAP subsidizes than the eating habits of the poor themselves, or the preferred eating habits, we'll say. But in short, you're essentially claiming that if 1/8 of Americans are on SNAP, that's got to be too many people. They can't all need food assistance. And your detractors are going to point out, access to SNAP is means tested. Your net income has to be below the poverty line for you to qualify. So around 13% of Americans are food insecure. That's pretty darn close to the SNAP numbers, right? So extreme food insecurity affects more like 5% of Americans. That's less. But does that mean that only 5% really need or deserve our help? And so, where are we drawing that? Obviously, a line has to be drawn somewhere. Right, but you're saying we should draw it significantly lower than I guess the federal government is saying we should draw it. So what's your argument for that? Or are you being kind of Scroogey here?
Yeah, certainly a lot of people would characterize it that way. I think that it's actually the opposite. It's that the welfare state, the leftist establishment, is being extremely over generous with the current program, and that we could rein it in without too many problems. So one of the things I point to is a 2021 study by the U.S. Department of Agriculture that looked at the health numbers of SNAP recipients. And you mentioned the stat, 39% of SNAP recipients are classified as obese. To flesh out those stats a little bit more, 26% are classified as overweight, 33% are normal weight, and 3% are underweight. So to be clear, 3% of the people receiving the food stamp program are considered underweight, according to the USDA. I think that's a pretty alarming statistic. I understand that weight is not all of health, and that this is at best a proxy for understanding someone's level of need. But I do think that a lot of people, when they hear those stats, would be a little bit shocked. When food stamps are discussed in the media, in rhetoric, a lot of people have this image in their mind of a saintly single mother who, has two or three kids, is struggling to afford groceries, doing everything she can, and like just on the brink of starvation. I think that that is not a realistic picture of what the average food stamp recipient looks like. I think a more realistic picture is frankly a little bit less flattering. And I think the level of need specifically is exaggerated. And that's why I don't think it would be a huge deal to cut food stamps considerably. What I proposed in the article is that a 50% cut would be a reasonable initial demand. And that's actually basically just going back to 2007 levels. Food stamps have been ballooning over the last 20 years. And so really, it would just be getting it back to where it was just a couple of decades ago. You mentioned food insecurity, and I'm glad you brought that up because it's an important point to address. There's a lot of statistics out there that suggest that there is a lot of hunger in America, and that but for these programs, lots of people would starve and stuff. And I think it's important to point out that those statistics can be very misleading. So food insecurity, when we talk about that, the question is, what is the question on the survey that they are asking people? And oftentimes when it comes to a label like food insecurity, the question is something like, at any time over the past year, have you ever doubted for a moment that you might not be able to afford exactly the kind of groceries you want at the quality you want, right? And so sometimes someone might say to themselves, well, I wanted to buy the more expensive version, but instead I had to go with the cheaper version. Okay, well, that person might qualify as food insecure, right? Even though they never suffered for quantity of food. Or maybe there's a family or an individual who for 5 or 10 days in the year had to buy a little bit less than they otherwise wanted to out of 365 days. Certainly that's regrettable. I have sympathy for that situation. If we're counting all of those people as food insecure, and then we bring out a number like 13% of Americans are food insecure, I think that's very misleading to the public to try to create the impression that there is a crisis, to create the impression that there's a widespread problem that needs billions and billions of dollars put towards it. I don't disagree that there's a problem, and I don't disagree that some Americans are absolutely starving and absolutely in need. I disagree about the framing of the scale of the problem. I think it's really overblown because the individuals who are creating these statistics and propagating them have a political agenda. And basically, they want to prey on our compassion. They want to go to us and pull at our heartstrings and say, oh, how could you not have sympathy for these unfortunate people who are going hungry? And my answer is, I do have sympathy. There is a wealth of private charitable initiatives which exist precisely to address this issue. There's also a number of government initiatives, but we got to draw a line somewhere. And I think when you look at obesity rates, when you look at the health outcomes, I think we're not talking about millions of people starving if we cut SNAP. What we're talking about is, yes, maybe a little bit more dependence on private charity. Maybe people would have to go out and work a little bit harder. And again, these people are in tough situations, but we need to be clear-headed about the numbers. And $100 billion are going to 42 million Americans. To me, this is way, way, way beyond what is reasonably justified by the actual facts on the ground.
Well, it's interesting. We talked about the definition of food insecure because, just last week I had to, spend, $30 less on groceries because, I didn't have enough money to cover it. I would not describe my family as food insecure, but, every now and then we've had to make decisions about what we can budget that week or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think you talked about people kind of preying on our compassion, advocates for increasing, benefits or whatever. And when you say preying, I'm imagining, people who, companies that sell, packed processed food, right? Because certainly they benefit from these programs because that money goes to them, right? But I'm imagining, a lot of people who are making these arguments are not necessarily trying to prey on anything, but they do have a sense of what they think is right. And there's this idea that, if there's any need at all, if anybody has ever had to start a GoFundMe to help with a medical, procedure, whatever, well, that should just be free. That should just be covered. We should live in the kind of society where anything you need should just be granted to you, right? And now that sounds kind of nice. I understand that the appeal of that. But essentially, you say you got to draw the line somewhere. there's certainly the farther left you go, the less there is a line. It's basically just, we just need to live in a society where, you know, smart people make decisions so that everybody has medical, you know, free insurance, free medical coverage, free food, free housing. And the difficulty there, I think, is that when you subsidize something, you get more of it, right? So when the government's saying, you know, you can stay at home and not work and we'll pay you, you're going to get more people who do that. And so that, I think that is one concern that people, especially maybe more on the right, are going to have, that, you know, yeah, I want to help people, but is it possible that there's people who are taking advantage or cutting corners because they have the ability to do so, and because it's in their self-interest to do so. And so I think that's an interesting point to consider. And I think that is kind of partly what you're saying here, is that there are people who maybe don't need this, but are, you know, it's available, so they're going to do it, right? So you, but maybe building on that a little bit, you talk in the article about the contact hypothesis, which is this idea that when you meet people in person whom you've been absorbing, you know, malicious lies or stereotypes about, you know, immigrants, Muslims, people of color, conservatives, whatever, you become more favorable to them when you meet them in person, rather than when all the knowledge you've had about them was secondhand, right? And however, there's some evidence that personal knowledge of poor people, at least in the affluent West, can have the opposite effect. That we start with a stereotype of the noble poor person, and then that gets complicated when we meet them in person and we realize that they're actually human beings, like we are. And anecdotally, I will say that my view of the poor, which incidentally I probably was at the time, was certainly at least complicated when I volunteered at my church's food co-op. And I saw that patterns of bad decisions like drug addiction, shacking up with obviously bad partners, having kids out of wedlock, et cetera, are a lot more common than we might like to think they are. And, you know, we don't have to be personally judgmental about that. There's systems, there's patterns, there's things you see that you know, do because you see your parents do it. You don't think about it, right? You know, you don't have to be super judgmental about it, but there is something to be said for that, you know, bad decisions lead to bad outcomes, right? And so we sort of imagine, like you say, you know, that person who's trying to do everything right and just nothing is working out for them. And those people do exist, but it's not all of them, right? It's not everybody who is poor is poor because they've just been down in their luck. Or maybe that's part of it, but not all of it, right? And so, but I've also done, you know, stuff like poverty immersion training formally, and also just, you know, by being poor. And I understand how difficult it can really be to get ahead once you've had a couple of setbacks. You know, the big difference between, you know, the rich and the poor, when we talk about this kind of moralizing about just make the right decisions or whatever, is that when you're rich, you can afford to make mistakes, but when you're poor, you don't, right? So if you're rich and you have a drug problem, well, you know, your dad plays golf with the judge, and so you can figure that out. Or, you know, you can screw off and you know, your dad is, you know, you can screw off and hang out with prostitutes and do drugs. And if your dad is, you know, Joe Biden, then, you know, you'll get a good job no matter what, right? So, and so do you really think that more personal interaction with the poor would make your average taxpayer less sympathetic to their plight rather than more so? Or do you think it would be a little complicated?
I do think that on average, more interaction with the poor would make people want to subsidize them less. I think people's overall impression would skew towards the negative side compared to what it was before they interacted. So yeah, so this part of my article, I call it optics, and I really talk about some of the parts of the food stamp debate that are more visible and conspicuous, and some of the parts that are more hidden. So we've already talked about one that's really visible, which is food bank lines, right? Whenever food banks get overwhelmed, there's a whole media storm about it. Everyone sees it. And that, of course, is very convenient for the leftists, because when people see long food bank lines, they think to themselves, oh my goodness, this is a real problem. We need to have the government give more money towards this. Some of the things about this debate that are more invisible are the things that I think, if they were more exposed, would make people less inclined to support a very large welfare state. So we've already talked about one, which is the neediness of the poor, looking at health statistics and obesity rates and starting to question, you know, how needy are people. But the thing is, the average voter I don't think is very familiar with these statistics about obesity among SNAP recipients. And I think if they were, they'd be a lot more hesitant to give money to the poor. Another factor, so there's neediness. Another factor that I talk about is deservingness. And this one is perhaps more controversial, but it's to question, like, a lot of poor people make some really bad choices. And I think if the average taxpayer who is subsidizing their grocery bill, had contact with, looked at, lived with these people and looked at some of the decisions that they're making, they would say, you know what, maybe I don't want to subsidize this to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, you know? So I talk about contact hypothesis. So most of us are actually familiar with contact hypothesis. We just don't know the jargon. So basically, it's the idea, you can imagine someone who is very xenophobic, right? Who thinks, oh, those people over there, I don't like them. They're not good people. They're whatever. But they've never actually met someone from the region that they're xenophobic about. And so the hypothesis is, well, what if we put them in contact with that person from this foreign region? And then sure enough, they get to know them and they realize, oh, they actually have a similar interest as me. And they're actually kind of a cool guy. And I like his sense of humor. And okay, you know, maybe people from that region aren't so bad, right? So that's contact hypothesis in general. Is it's this idea that putting people in contact with one another can maybe alleviate some of the animosity that would exist and the prejudice that exists just from an ignorance, right? A lack of knowledge. There's a science blogger called Emil Kierkegaard who takes this a step further, and he presents some interesting evidence to say it's not so much that you will always take a bad opinion, and then when you have contact, it turns into a better opinion, right? So that's the example I just gave. You have a negative opinion towards someone, you come into contact with them, and then as a result of that contact, your opinion of them improves. What Kierkegaard suggests is that actually what contact hypothesis is it's going from a less accurate opinion to a more accurate opinion. And so as a result of that, you might also get the flip side. So you might have a really good opinion of a certain class of people, and then you actually meet them and you're like, oh, they aren't as good as I was led to believe. Actually, I think they're a little bit worse. And so in Kierkegaard's presentation, contact hypothesis can work either ways. It can either take a poor opinion and make it better, or a good opinion to make it worse. And what I would argue, and he also has a tweet about this that I feature, is that with respect to poverty, I think a lot of the times we have a relatively good image of poor people in our minds that's portrayed to us by the media that's trying to drum up support for an expanded welfare state. And then when we actually come into contact with the average poor person, and again, these are obviously generalizations. There are many poor people who are lovely and who do make good decisions. But I think on average, a lot of people would be very surprised at the level of poor decision-making because it comes down to everyone has sympathy for poor people suffering for things that are beyond their control. When you get an injury or an illness, when you get laid off from work, when you have certain things that are just completely not your fault, I think there's a lot of sympathy for that. What there's a lot less sympathy for is when a poor person goes out and repeatedly makes bad choices, bad financial choices, bad lifestyle choices, bad relationship choices. And certainly people are familiar with these categories. I don't think people appreciate enough the degree to which poverty is caused by poor people themselves just making really bad choices. And so there's some interesting evidence for this. I talk about Caleb Hammer, who's a famous YouTuber who has a show called Financial Audit, and he talks to individuals who are struggling financially. And basically, the show unintentionally exposes that a lot of people who are struggling financially like really only have themselves to blame. And so a lot of people's reaction to Caleb Hammer's show has actually been, wow, maybe these poor people don't deserve our money as much as I thought they did. I also point to an interesting 2024 study in the British Journal of Political Science, which found that exposure to poor people weakens support for redistribution among the rich. So when you ask this question about, on net, would people be less supportive of welfare or more supportive of welfare if they came into contact with the poor? Certainly, I think you're right. They would, to a degree, learn that being poor is really difficult and that there's a lot of traps and that they face challenges that a lot of people from more privileged backgrounds probably can't relate to and can't appreciate. I think that's absolutely a factor. I think that would be outweighed by the realization that a lot of poor people make very terrible choices that are largely the cause of their poverty. And I think that's borne out in the evidence, both the anecdotal evidence that we see with people like Caleb Hammer and the discourse on Twitter around him, and also this study in the British Journal of Political Science. And I think it when you start to become familiar with the statistics around this, and certainly I think people who have a lot of exposure to poorer elements of society would testify that, yeah, it's a lot worse than a lot of people think.
Hey everyone, it's Doug from LCI. As you may know, the team at Podsworth Media has worked with us for a long time, producing our content for most of the Christians for Liberty network. A big part of that over the past couple of years has been using the Podsworth app to make our audio sound clean, level, and professional, even when the raw recordings were super sketchy, like this one you're listening to right now. Believe it or not, this recording was that bad before I ran it through the Podsworth app, and you can hear the full before and after demo yourself at podsworth.com. The app recently got a huge update, and it's now better than ever. So good, in fact, that it can take almost any atrocious voice recording and make it sound great. Here's how it works. It removes background noise, cuts down on plosives, fixes clipping when your gain is too high, removes clicks and pops, reduces reverb, improves tone, and levels out the dialogue so that you don't get any crazy volume jumps. Everybody hates that in a podcast. Using it is super simple. You just go to podsworth.com and click Get Started, drag and drop the audio files, open them right up from your phone's browser, customize your settings however you want. But honestly, the default works great for most settings. And here's the really cool thing. If you enter code LCI50, you'll get 50% off your first order. No account needed, just your email and payment. You'll get a download link in your inbox with cleaned up files. It's perfect for podcasts, YouTube videos, sermons, audiobooks, you name it. If your recording sounds rough, the Podsworth app can make it not only sound listenable, but professional. And remember, when you use code LCI50, you get half off your first order, and you'll also be supporting the work here at LCI.
Yes, certainly more complicated. I mean, I can imagine it maybe kind of really depending on, like you said, where you start from, partly, that, you know, somebody who is inclined to think of the poor as, you know, just welfare queens or whatever. If they're exposed to a diverse, a number of them, they would mm-hmm. have a much more nuanced opinion and would probably be much more compassionate. Whereas mm-hmm. somebody who's coming in with a very sort of progressive viewpoint that anybody who's poor is necessarily oppressed, which, you know, through much of human history has been largely true, but it's not partly true now, but not nearly as true as it has been in the past. And it still is in some other places in the world, that when you live in a society that's relatively free, you do have more opportunities. You're not necessarily being forced down, but you can sort of be held down by circumstances or, whatever. Just to give an example of negative contact hypothesis, that maybe this is just a personal anecdote, but I was recently invited to attend a meet and greet with Vivek Ramaswamy, who's running for governor in Ohio and has some libertarian inclinations, but he's also kind of hitched to the coattails of MAGA a little bit. And I came away with a more positive opinion of him, but a more negative opinion of all of my Republican neighbors who were there. Not all of them. Mm-hmm. There are a few I had good conversations with, but I thought, man, I've kind of been trying to say that not all Republicans are racist, but maybe they are, or at least mostly. In that case, I was trying to hold on to a more positive opinion, and then I realized that it's a little more complicated. That actually, it's more negative than I'd thought. So let's say you're right about all this, and but you do imagine a question in the article that Bayer might ask someone like you, and I'll repeat it here because I think it's a good question. Since the kind of free market reforms you'd like to see aren't realistic in the short term, the practical policy question is what we should do on the margin today, starting from the status quo. So if you're keen to help the poor, wouldn't you agree that, from your perspective, free trade, et cetera, should be implemented first, and that welfare programs should be maintained until such a time as your free market policies have worked their magic, and only then, as one of the last items in the transition to pure capitalism, we wind those down? And so that's the question that you postulate. Yeah. And as a bleeding heart libertarian myself, that question resonates with me. I think some people want to, you know, cut all the welfare programs first. I want to see, you know, I want to see people who have having the opportunity to thrive before we pull the rug out from under them. So what would you say to that hypothetical question, or to someone like me who thinks that, well, maybe there is some wisdom to that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I guess I'm congratulating myself if yes. I say that. But no, I think it's a fair question, and that's why I raise it. I think it's important to address. So a little bit of background. First of all, us free marketers are absolutely convinced that one thing we could do today to help end poverty would be to go in a free market direction, right? So free trade, end the minimum wage, end occupational licensing. Like, we have a list of policy prescriptions that we want, not just because we think it will help the economy in general, not just because it will advance freedom, but specifically because we think some of these measures are very good for the poor themselves. You know, the minimum wage is a hotly contested debate, but really any of these and just the litany of regulations that exist that are making everything more expensive, our groceries, our laundry machines, our dishwashers, our clothes, our houses, cars, like, people don't appreciate the degree to which we could solve poverty just by moving in a free market direction. At least that's my position.
Not to stop your train of thought, yeah. But we've already seen it, right? I mean, this is the work that we've seen from, you know, Cato and Human Progress, mm-hmm. that they've demonstrated that all these benefits that we have today that make this world so much different than the world that, you know, we had inherited, mm-hmm. it are those free market light interventions that once you sort of introduce capitalism to the equation, you start eviscerating even global poverty, even poverty in places where capitalism is really not even being followed. You're seeing just sort of incredible overflow of prosperity. So, but yeah, so I agree with you. We if we keep going in that direction, we'll have even more opportunities to help people who are in need, who could take advantage of those opportunities.
Yeah. And so that's kind of the background context. But then I can imagine a leftist saying something like the following. Okay, granted that all your free market policies will have all of the magical utopian benefits that you say they will. What do we do on the margin, right? So in economics, one of the things economists like to talk about is this idea of thinking on the margin. And basically what that means is whenever we do things, we need to make priorities and we need to ask, not just what should happen, but what should happen next, and what should happen in increments, right? And so when we imagine something like scaling back the state, it's all well and good that, you know, all of us libertarians can agree that we want to get to a future world where the state plays a minimal role or a non-existent role in everything. But then the question becomes, how do we get from here to there? And I can imagine a leftist saying, okay, if you genuinely want to help the poor, and if you think these free market reforms are the way to get there, well, wouldn't you agree that let's make all your free market reforms first and then cut welfare, as opposed to maybe doing them simultaneously or even cutting welfare first? And I think that's a pretty valid argument. And so the thought experiment I give in the article is I say, okay, first of all, my gut reaction is no, cut everything, you know, as fast as you can. But then I say, well, okay, hang on. He does have a point. This hypothetical leftist that we're talking to. Imagine that we're talking about someone who is in prison. And let's say that they are in prison for a nonviolent crime, something that libertarians would say it's completely unethical to lock this person up, you know, a drug charge, whatever, but this person is in prison. And part of being in prison, of course, is that you get government subsidized food, your prison food, right? That prison food is paid for by taxpayer dollars. So a person might ask a libertarian, okay, would you say that the government should stop providing this government-subsidized food for prisoners because, you know, taxation is theft and we want to lower taxes? And it's like, well, yes, but also release the prisoner. And then they say, okay, but like, should we stop providing the food before the prisoners are released? Like, if we're telling you we're not going to release the prisoners, do you still want us to stop providing prisoners with government-subsidized food because that'll save taxes? And that's where I have to be like, okay. Obviously, that's unreasonable. Like, yes, I want to let the prisoners out and stop giving them government-subsidized food. But as long as we're going to hold them prisoner, sure, maybe it makes sense for the government to give them food. And the reason I make that analogy is because in the libertarian viewpoint, the whole state is basically an open-air prison, right? We are not free to pursue whatever career we want unless we get the government permission through an occupational license. We are not free to do a whole bunch of things to better ourselves, to make our own living and make our own way. And so in light of the fact that there are thousands of government restrictions upon our lives, our ability to earn a living, our ability to make our way in the world and fend for ourselves, is it reasonable to say, as long as those restrictions exist, let's also have some government food support? And if you don't like those restrictions, let's get rid of those restrictions first. And only after those are gone, get rid of the government food support. I'm very sympathetic to that argument. I think, there's a degree to which we need to be pragmatists. I'm always conscious of Rothbard's comments on strategy. So Rothbard identifies two polar extremes that we need to stay away from. The one polar extreme is like extreme Puritanism, right? And so that would be the example of saying, no, we shouldn't even have taxpayer money going to food for prisoners because taxation is theft. And that is extreme Puritanism to the point of completely ignoring any practical on the ground realities. And Rothbard cautions against that kind of idealistic, like rigid dogmatism, because first of all, it's not going to be compelling to people who are trying to win over. But also, it's not a realistic policy. It's not a good idea. However, a lot of people who rightly reject Puritanism and dogmatism and being super doctrinaire on libertarian theory go to the opposite extreme. And the opposite extreme is just compromising principle left, right, and center and saying, oh yeah, we don't need to worry too much and basically pandering to more mainstream ideas about, oh, well, you know, of course we need a welfare state and of course we need this and of course we need the government to do that. And Rothbard also cautioned against that extreme. And what he said is we need to hold the principle high. We need to say this is our end goal and this is what we're striving towards. And here is going to be a realistic policy for how to get there. And so that's kind of what I try to do. I think Javier Milei, in many ways, is doing a good job of that. Everyone knows that he's an ANCAP. Everyone knows that his final goal is a Rothbardian kind of society. And on the ground, he's trying to implement practical measures to move towards economic freedom. Certainly, there's lots of debates that can be had about whether he's going about that the right way, whether he's doing it fast enough. But I like that idea that we need to balance, on the one hand, holding the principles high and not compromising on the principles just because it would be politically convenient. But on the other hand, having a sense of practicality and reasonableness about all of this. And so to this thought experiment, I basically say, yes, in general, let's try to work on scaling back government red tape first before tackling the welfare state. However, I don't think that means that we can just not touch the welfare state until all of the government red tape is rolled back, because I think that's also unreasonable, right? Like, are you telling me that we have to keep every single government welfare program exactly $100 billion for SNAP funding and everything until the last shred of red tape and labor laws and free trade laws are gone away? I think that's silly. I think that we can still make considerable cuts to welfare programs today, and it's not like all hell is going to break loose. And to the degree that that creates more poverty or exacerbates the issue of poverty, then all the more reason to move as fast as we can towards free markets.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I think there's a danger if we don't do this right or close to right, then we maybe don't get a chance to do it again, right? So if we imagine a Javier Milei, you know, style president in the United States, if he starts just kind of taking the axe to random crap, like, you know, Trump has done here and there, then you know, what's going to happen is people who might be sympathetic are going to lose that sympathy when they see people getting hurt, you know, that they, you know, obviously care about and think, you know, shouldn't be hurt. So yeah, I think there's a certain deliberation you have to do about, okay, you know, what do we cut first? How do we do it? But I think you're right. There are some reasonable cuts that we can make to a lot of these things, even without a free market society. The libertarian thought experiment is like, you know, if you push the button and, you know, make this disappear or whatever. So if you could push a button and make SNAP disappear today, or there's another button And that, you know, frees up markets and then, you know, cuts welfare programs progressively over the next, you know, 4 or 5 years. Which would you do? Would you do the one that just makes SNAP disappear today? Or would you do the one that says, well, we can be cutting it over the next few years while we're freeing up markets?
Yeah, I mean, these are always kind of tricky thought experiments. I think on principle, I have to say cut it today. What people forget is that SNAP is only one of a number of welfare programs at the federal, state, local level. And that's on top of all of the private charitable initiatives that obviously from church initiatives to larger organizations. And so I think if we could get rid of SNAP in one fell swoop, that would be a huge step in the right direction. And I'd be willing to press that button. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, so I mean, this is an example that I've brought up a number of times, which is there's someone who's close to me who's a type 1 diabetic. And because of the way government patents work, her insulin is, you know, unnecessarily inflated in cost. And if there was competition, that would not be the case. And so this friend does take advantage of, who's kind of more libertarian leaning. She does take advantage of, you know, kind of a state Medicaid type thing that makes that affordable. And I don't blame her for that. And in fact, mm-hmm. I wouldn't really honestly want to see that funding go away, especially when it comes to life-saving medications until we actually had a free market in medicine. And so that, I think that's, you know, even it's tough because I understand on principle we're talking about is the government stealing and we want that to end. But I do think there's a certain sense in which we do have to be thoughtful about how we do that. We can't just sort of say, well, this is right on principle. And so if millions die, well, at least it was right on principle, right? I think it's also right on principle to try to, you know, you know, do this in a responsible way, I think.
Of course. And just on that point, obviously, yeah. When lives are on the line, that's a huge difference. And part of why I'm okay with getting rid of SNAP is because I don't think there's a lot of lives on the line. If we got rid of SNAP, again, 3% of SNAP recipients are underweight, right? Yeah. Almost certainly private charity could pick up at least that slack and make sure that no one dies of starvation. And so that's why I'm okay with that. Certainly if lives are on the line, that's a different discussion.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned cutting it in half to where we're really talking about maybe more extreme food insecurity or whatever. Would that be a cut you'd be more comfortable making? I push the button, we're going to cut it in half now, and then we'll work on cutting the rest of it over the next 4 years or something? Or
yeah. So what I said in the article is I think cutting it in half would be a reasonable initial demand. Mm-hmm. So basically, this is my compromise position. I think we should just get rid of it right away, but I know most people aren't going to be game for that, and I can understand some hesitation. And so I said, okay, well, let's at least cut it in half to start. And I'm intentionally shocking people because most people will say, oh, let's cut 5%, 10%. I'm saying, look, no, it's doubled over the last 20 years. Cutting it in half means going back to 2006, 2007 levels, right? Like that's not actually as radical as it sounds when you just say cut it in half. And I'm trying to shock people out of this complacency of 5% reforms, 10% reforms.
Right.
I think if you look at the numbers, SNAP funding actually fluctuates quite a bit by, 10 or 20% over a period of 5 or 10 years. And so I really want to push people into thinking more radically. And so half, just an immediate across the board 50% cut is like a compromise position that I think is still radical and forces people to start thinking outside the Overton window, but maybe doesn't force them to go commit for all the way right away.
Got it. Well, so this is the Libertarian Christian podcast, and you and I share a faith in Jesus. So I think we can bring in the Christian aspect here a little mm-hmm. bit and not just talk about policy and Rothbard. So, you know, as a Christian, I concur with Paul that the one who's unwilling to work shouldn't eat. And incidentally, there are, you know, work requirements for SNAP, which have knocked a number of past beneficiaries off the program. But I also see in Scripture over and over again the importance of generosity, and we can leave aside the fact that confiscation and redistribution is not the same as generosity. But in the Old Testament, it was, you know, mandated that, you know, that there would be generosity toward the poor through gleaning, tithing laws, that kind of thing. And so even if our ultimate goal is a stateless society, couldn't a solid argument be made that we should be very concerned about not hurting the least of these on the way there? And so we've kind of addressed this just from a sense of compassion, but is there an explicitly Christian argument here that we need to be taking into consideration with how we want to approach this?
Yeah, well, I think one Christian argument that should be front of mind in these conversations is when Jesus in Matthew 20 told people not to rule over others. You know that the rulers of the world lord it over their subjects, and their great ones exercise authority over them. He said, it shall not be so with you, or it shall not be so among you. And there's a number of other verses that I think point to this idea that Christians are not supposed to be coercing their fellow man. Christians are not supposed to be imposing their values and their ideas and their opinions onto others. Our virtue should be in the form of setting an example, right? So absolutely, generosity is important, but I don't think we see any, at least New Testament examples, of Christians saying, oh, you know what? Jesus really told us to be generous, so we're going to go petition Caesar to raise our taxes so that he can spend more money on the poor. Or, you know what? We're going to form a government so that we can start extorting at all of our neighbors so that they can... No, we're going to form a voluntary community, they said, that is going to be generous and giving and compassionate to those in need. And so I think that the theme of Scripture and especially of the early church was always about voluntary giving. And just to be clear, like I'm a huge proponent of voluntary giving. This is the Christian libertarian alternative to the statist paradigm that says the only way or the best way or the primary way to help the poor is to have the government tax us more and redistribute. And obviously, there's a whole bunch of great arguments about why private charity is also more effective. It's more direct. It's not as impersonal. It's not as bureaucratic. And so there are like logistical arguments. But then I think that Christians are commanded to, right? Paul says, as much as it is possible, live peaceably with one another. Well, going around to our neighbors and saying, hey, give me your money so that I can help this poor person, I don't think that's living out Paul's command to live peaceably as much as possible. In 1 Thessalonians 4, he talks about the importance of minding our own business, you know? And I interpret that in a kind of libertarian sense of like, hey, maybe I shouldn't be spending my life and my time meddling with other people's financial decisions. Everyone's going to make their own choices about how they spend their money, how they spend their time, where they invest. My choice is going to be, how can I look out for the needs of the people in my community and have compassion and generosity for them? And so for me, not only does Christian principle not endorse any kind of statist action, but really Christian principle teaches us to turn away from relying on the state to help others and instead seeking out voluntary means.
Right. Well, talk to me a little bit about this idea of subsidiarity, that not everything has to be kind of done at the highest level. So, you know, prior to the creation of the welfare state, there were, you know, voluntary organizations like mutual aid societies that perform some of the functions that we now expect of government. Do you think that the transition to this new government order hurt the church? Did it hurt communities, people in need themselves? Do you think that there have been any benefits, just thinking in terms of a kind of a Thomas Sowellian, you know, trade-offs approach? We may not like it, but, you know, very few changes have only negative consequences. There's sometimes benefits. What do you think of that transition from a more voluntary society to a more centralized society? What have we lost? And is there anything that we've gained?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. It reminds me of a book by, I think it's David Beto, called From Mutual Aid to the Welfare State. And he chronicles the history of specifically American welfare policy and how there used to be a wide network of mutual aid societies where these were very local bodies, sometimes tied to a profession or a religious community or whatever. And it was just people getting together, almost like insurance, but a much more community-based insurance, looking out for one another. They would have doctors on call. They would have a whole bunch of supports available for people in that community who fell on hard times. And one of the things that scholars note is that there has been this huge transition that you alluded to from this very local, community-oriented approach to welfare to a very centralized, bureaucratic approach, right? And so we see all of these big programs, food stamps is one of them, maybe Social Security would be another, unemployment insurance, where suddenly the state and specifically the federal government is taking over a greater and greater role in taking care of the needs of the poor. And a lot of people have pointed to a lot of really negative consequences about this. As I mentioned, it depersonalizes it. Obviously, it introduces an element of coercion. A lot of people would point out that the bureaucratic structure is very inefficient. And it also isn't able to be as targeted as it can be, right? When you have people in the community who you actually know, the Mormons are very good about this. Rothbard in For New Liberty really praises the Mormons for being exemplary in showing how communities can look after one another without having to depend on the state. They do an excellent job at that. And I think that that's a model that there's no reason we can't emulate that, especially in other Christian communities and whatnot. And so you ask, was there any benefit? Like, certainly I'm always sympathetic to the Sowell argument of there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. One that comes to mind, maybe there's economies of scale, right? So anytime you can do something in a more centralized way, then, you know, if there's a fixed factor that needs to be done no matter what, then if you can do it on a larger scale, then it will be cheaper overall. I do think if there is that, then it's outweighed by all of the negatives I just listed. I think that this is a history that's really important to learn. A lot of people aren't familiar with how actually a lot of the things that we assume the state has to do and that the private sector could never do, actually the private sector was doing it 100 years ago. And these things have slowly been co-opted by the state over the last 100 years. And so I would love to see us start to go back to that kind of subsidiary model where church groups, professional groups, different community arts groups, there's a whole bunch of different groups that already exist. So much of civil society is local. You know, we forget that in our day-to-day lives, it's the people around us, it's the people in our different communities, and the people where we live, work, learn, and play, who are really forming the main part of the community that we live in. And I think that there's a lot of value in turning to that community as opposed to turning to a place possibly hundreds or thousands of miles away in Washington, D.C., and assuming that they would understand a local community's needs, right? This is the other thing that we have to appreciate is the knowledge problem. You know, this is kind of a Hayekian point. Washington, D.C. doesn't really know the needs of a small town in Florida, you know? And they don't really know the needs of a small town in Montana and California and Maine. America is a massive country. There are a whole bunch of different types of people groups, the Amish, from rich to poor, and all around. The idea that one centralized system would be well equipped to address the unique welfare needs of all of these diverse communities, that I think is what's really utopia.
Well, yeah, and it's the kind of thing that the left tends to reject to and calls colonialism. And under certain circumstances, when there's maybe crossing color lines or continent lines. But yes, they don't always make that same distinction when it comes to federal government. Well, Patrick Carroll, the article, Why SNAP Spending Should Be Cut Even If Charity Doesn't Replace It, can be read at againsttheleft.substack.com. I'll put a link in the show notes. I'll also put a link to your Twitter handle for those who are just listening, Patrick C. 1995. I appreciate so much the time that you've made to talk with us. It's a really interesting article, really thought-provoking, obviously. And some people may bristle, and some people may say, heck yeah. But I think it's worth considering either way. So thanks so much, Patrick.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.